the approach to religion by the man of the world is an irreligious approach. The worldly mind has no conception whatsoever of what the heart of religion is concerned with. The heart of religion, as actually taught in the great religions, is concerned with the transcendent. And the transcendent cannot be understood, cannot be rightly approached by man as he is, with the sort of mind which he has. We all approach religion as predators. We want to grab something, to get something out of it. We approach religion as refugees. We want to run away from our difficulties, our troubles. We can't deal with them. So we call upon religion to help us out of the mess. But we have a preconception of what is meant by being helped out of the mess. We want to be put back into a situation which is agreeable to us, according to our conceptions. This is where the trouble comes. Religion has nothing to do with all that. Religion is not intended to solve our human problems in the human way. It is not even intended to solve any problems whatsoever. It belongs to a transcendent sphere altogether. And this is what we don't understand. If you consider the matter seriously, you will see that all the great teachers never propounded a philosophy, never threw out a system for the benefit of man in political, economic, social, health, or any other terms. To all our human problems, they gave a transcendent answer, not a human answer. Not a system, not a method. All that they did teach forcefully and perfectly was how one should live the good life. But it didn't need the great teachers to tell us that. You and I know equally well we should be truthful, we should be kind and gentle and all the rest of it. That is all they taught precisely. But the way they presented it implied something which belonged to a context which completely transcended our human context. This is the important point. It rests with us to enter into that context. The context, the transcendent context, is here, right and now. So we have teachings like the omnipresence of God. See? Well, if God is omnipresent, right here, you don't have to go anywhere to realize God. Which also means that the transcendent, that the infinite, the absolute, is not a spatial thing or force or energy. It is not a temporal thing or force or energy. It is in terms of absoluteness. And because it is in terms of absoluteness, it completely wipes out all our particular contexts set up by our minds. our space-time concept, context. Our context of a way of life, a system which we might apply to every different sphere of life. These are all contexts which are manufactured by our minds. But our minds are greedy, resentful, stupid, incapable, etc., etc., etc. What virtues we arrogate to ourselves are very ephemeral things altogether. They belong to the ambivalent sphere of the virtue and its opposite vice. When we talk of love, this love is within the orbit of the love-hate complex. If we talk of truthfulness, it's in the ambit of the love of the truth, falsehood context, and so forth. A transcendent love, or truth, or goodness, or beauty, is something which our minds are totally unacquainted with. Totally. We don't have little wisdom in relation to God. Either we have wisdom where God is concerned, where the Absolute is concerned, or we have no wisdom at all. That is one of the meanings and significances of transcendence, that it is absolute. This is not absoluteness in the totalitarian sense of the word. That is to say, the human totalitarian sense of the word. And this is where those aspects of different religions which claim finality of revelation are altogether foolish, totally false, and unhappily, wickedly cruel. We have seen that in history through the ages. See? So we must really understand this first. That this thing which we call religion belongs to a context which is right away beyond us. In that case, it will be asked, well, what on earth are we trying to do if it is totally beyond us? It is totally beyond us as we are now. That is the point. We being what we are now are unable to realize that the transcendent context is right here, immediately here. Immediately, that means without anything in between. Immediately here, right now. And if and when the realization of that transcendence can take place, then this entire worldly context is transformed into the truly religious context. Going to the office, which is in the worldly context, cooking our meals, going to the theater, giving a concert, or whatever it is, which is all in terms of the worldly context, becomes changed into the perfect expression of the transcendent context and the transcendent realization. And the transformation that takes place is the transformation in our own awareness, our own consciousness, our own wide awakeness, which comes into being as and when the mind is purified. It is simplified. And this purification and simplification of the mind will necessarily mean that all our ordinary concepts, all our ordinary interpretations of our total experience from moment to moment undergoes a complete empty. The mind becomes utterly empty, utterly silent. And in that utter emptiness and silence is the luminosity. Then the light of God, the light of the transcendent, is there shining unhindered. You find in the Gita You will find it in the Upanishads. You will find it in the Buddha's teaching. You will find it in Jesus' teaching. The light of lights, as it is called. That light of lights is not something which emanates from or is granted to us by some other being, some postulated entity, God. There is no such thing. Reality is, it's total. It is limitless. And it is limitless both in terms of infinity, of boundlessness, as well as of pointedness. The point is the infinity of the small. The total universe is the infinity of the large. But infinity as infinity completely transcends the limitation of space and distance, measurability. We can only measure distance between two particular limited separate things. But where infinity is concerned, there is no measurement. Infinity, if realized, means omnipresence. That is why we say God is omnipresent. It means omnipresence. Distance has no meaning. Because remember, the ultimate being, the ultimate experiencing, is also the total and the ultimate awareness, consciousness. But where is consciousness? Here, there, can you catch it? Can you weigh it? Can you smell it? Can you taste it? Can you hide it? Can you bank it? You can't. See, this is the transcendent mystery which is embodied in us. Not only in us, in each and everything that comes within the scope of our vision and our experience. So, this purification of the mind, which is a complete emptying of the mind, of all our old beliefs, our concepts, our ideas, our conclusions, our scientific and otherwise verifications, and all the rest of it, must just vanish away. All these are like solid objects, or like mists, like fogs, which obscure the light of reality. When all these are out of our mind, the light of reality shines. And you won't need to be told, you won't need to look for it, because you are it. Being and awareness are identical. God is not there or there or there. Nor is God just here or here or here. It's the totality, the absoluteness. If that sense of totality, of absoluteness, completely fills us, then there is no separation whatsoever between what is commonly called I, John Smith, and you, Dick Patterson, or whoever it may be. There is no separation. And when that awareness of separation is gone, is completely absent, then there is no conflict. And in that condition, there is no evil. There is only the universal process which goes on happily and continuously altogether. Because all our petty little values, which are all tainted by our pleasure drive, our greed, our resentment, our stupidity, and all the rest of it, all our petty little values are out. They disappear for good. And you can breathe like a free man. Breathe happily the air of heaven. All the time. This is a question of the complete transformation of one's awareness. And in that state, there is neither the weak nor the strong. There is neither the oppressor nor the oppressed. That is why, in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, for instance, it has been said, there a father is not a father, a mother a mother, a thief a thief, a saint a saint. There is no separation, there is only the one and only and secondless, without a second, reality. I said there is neither the weak nor the strong there. You know how easily we human beings rush to another for some comfort. We want to be comforted. We start as soon as we can sort of make our presence felt to our mothers or fathers, and we have learned the little art of cajoling them or fooling them into getting what we want. Right from the word go, we start like little robbers, as infants, charming little robbers, you see. So we run to mummy for comfort, or to daddy for comfort, and we play one against the other, don't we? Very, very skillfully and very, very nicely. We go to somebody else for comfort, and we do the same through our life. When we feel confused, upset, worried, frightened, anxious, then too, oh, let me go and see so-and-so. Now, he's a wise man. He knows about these things. I'm sure he'll be able to help me out of this difficulty. Now, this is a serious matter. I mean, this kind of sorrow and anxiety and difficulty afflicts every human being. It has afflicted me through years and years. I know from experience. You know from your experience that this is so. This is how we do live. This is what we do. See, we go to somebody else for the comfort, for the help, for the assistance. But those of us who have a certain type of inner strength, who have a certain type of doggedness and willfulness, and who have sufficient egoism, I'm damned if I'm going to anybody, I'm jolly well going to do this. I am an oppressor, born and bred. I am going to dominate the situation somehow or other. Even if it means crushing my own desires or longings or my natural humanness, if necessary, in order that I may stand on my own feet. It's my conceit and my pride. I stand on my own feet. One day my feet will be broken by the Lord. And then, perhaps I will supply material to some orator or to some poet and say, he went down fighting. His head was bloody but unbowed. And all the rest of it. All very beautiful. These heroics are marvelous, of course. You can get nice little metal discs, you know, medals for things like that, and win great renown and all the rest of it. And the approbation and applause of the gaping multitude for it, you see, for what it is worth. But either this sort of standing on your own feet from within, this strength from within as we call it, or the running for comfort to another, they both lie within this false context of duality, which makes the wheel of sorrow, dukkha, turn round. And it's funny. This sort of view is the view of those, when I say view, I don't mean just an intellectual idea. I mean the outlook, the actual operating outlook and attitude of those who are caught up in worldliness. Why do I want to display such heroics? Because I gain something out of it. There can be no gain unless there is a separate I. But what is the fact of nature? What is the fact of life? There are apparently multitudinous particulars which make just one total whole. Supposing you suddenly became God, and you just looked at the universe. You just look at the universe like that, like your toy. You won't evaluate one part more than another. And if you see any one part sort of making a show of it, you'll probably say, that conceited little thing, why can't it be quiet? That is all, that is what you as God would say. Very likely. I don't know, because I'm not God. I can only conjecture in this matter. See, but this separate I is at play there all the time. And in the other situation, it is also the separate I at play, which runs to another for comfort. Now, if one is seriously concerned with religion, with the context of the transcendent, then who or what is meant by the comforter? What is meant by comfort in the transcendent sense? Look, you know how, for instance, in the Gospel of St. John, the 16th chapter, you get these verses. These things have I spoken unto you, that ye should not be offended. They shall put you out of the synagogues. Yea, the time cometh that whosoever killeth you will think that he doeth God service. And these things will they do unto you, because they have not known the Father, not known me. But these things have I told you, that when the time shall come, ye may remember that I told you of them. And these things I said not unto you at the beginning, because I was with you. But now I go my way to him that sent me, and none of you asketh me, whither goest thou? How very pregnant is that verse. But because I have said these things unto you, sorrow hath filled your heart. See, Jesus had become Christ. Paul refers to him often as Christ Jesus. The term Christ is a term which stands for transcendence. It is the totality, the all, the absolute. Just as, for example, we have a Trinity when we talk of God. In Christian terms, Father, Son, Holy Ghost. In Hindu terms, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. In Egyptian terms, we had Isis, Osiris, Horus, and so on. We have a Trinity like that, you see. Similarly, God, Christ, and the Virgin Mary is one of the Christian Trinities. Very much soft pedal, because ordinary Christian theology is always up against this problem of Trinity in unity. Christendom wants to uphold a unitary conception of God, because it claims descent from the Jewish tradition, which upholds a completely unitary God. So think the Jews, but they themselves actually have a male-female God. Yehovah, Yahweh, Yod, Hava, is male-female. It is not a unitary male God at all, in actual fact. Although they fondly believe that theirs is just a male God as such. But it isn't. The very name contradicts that. Although Jewish scholars are not prepared to admit that. The Jewish mystics have seen it, of course, and they have written about it, and so forth. All right. Now, just let's look at that again. And these things I said not unto you at the beginning, because I was with you. There was Jesus the Christ and the disciples Peter, James, John, etc., who are not the Christ, each one of them. So the relationship between the disciples and Jesus was a relationship of dependence. A relationship where the disciples are weak in relation to the Master. They are weak. They depend upon the Master. And that dependence is due to the fact that they are aware of themselves in separatist terms. I am James, I am John, I am Peter, you are Jesus the Christ. So you see, it was a relationship where a separately self-conscious man placed dependence upon another man, put himself in a position of dependence upon another man, Jesus. Because I was with you. But Jesus is talking of himself as Jesus the Christ. But now I go my way to him that sent me. Who can go his way to the Father? Only one who is in such complete unity with the Father that it makes no difference where he is or in what condition he is. In another place Jesus says, believe me, I am in the Father and the Father is in me. He says that very distinctly and very clearly. Unequivocally he says it. Which means that the Father is not there upstairs, up above the sky or something like that. But the Father and I are really one and the same thing. The Father is in me, and I am in the Father. There was, in other words, he was declaring the realization of transcendence in exactly the same way as the great Upanishadic teachers said, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahma. What an extraordinarily conceited statement the intelligent man of the world would say. How could anybody be considered a great spiritual teacher if he quietly tells you, I am God? He would say, well, you better see my friend Mr. George Brown, who is a psychiatrist. Isn't that so? But this is simple truth, and you can't escape it. But now I go my way to him that sent me, and none of you asketh me, whither goest thou? Jesus knew that they were still unable to make the grave. But if they only asked him, whither goest thou? He could have, and if they were in the right sort of condition, in mind and in consciousness, he could perhaps have induced in them the realization of transcendence then and there. But not one of them really asked. When they afterwards did ask, you see, they didn't quite understand what he meant when he answered them. But because I have said these things unto you, sorrow hath filled your heart. But this sorrow includes fear and ignorance. They didn't know. They were afraid. They were anxious. And they were sorrowful. We shall lose this man, Jesus, the son of his father and mother, whom we knew these months and years. So sorrow filled their heart. Caught up, still caught up in this dualistic context. Nevertheless, I tell you the truth. It is expedient for you that I go away. For if I go not away, the Comforter will not come unto you. And in another place, he also says who the Comforter is. The Spirit of Truth. The fact, as Krishnamurti would say. The fact, the truth, the actual what is. You know, when Krishnamurti tells us, examine the what is and really completely see and understand the what is, what lies behind that? What lies involved in that? If you and I actually see the whole truth of the what is, we shall be seeing transcendence concretized. That is the what. In Genesis, and God said, let there be light, and there was light, and God said, let there be so and so, and let them bring forth so and so. And each time he saw that it was good. All right. Let you and me look at this tape recorder, look at these chairs, this carpet, each other, and be able to see that it is, you are good. Good in the godly sense means the absolute good, which means the transcendence, doesn't it? And that is the truth. Not as an external manifestation merely as an objective fact, but as a total and endless and beginningless experiencing here now. That here is, this is transcendence. This is life eternal, life abundant, and one is aware of it. And this is the meaning of, this is one of the meanings of the statement in the Chandogya Upanishad. Brahman is prana, Brahman is life. It doesn't mean merely our biological life. It means life in that sense, in that transcendent sense. So when Krishnamurti says, see and know the what is, it means also see and know eternal God. Surely. Don't tell him this because he'll argue it away with you. He'll start off by saying the word is not the thing, you must, etc. You know, his delightful way of doing it. Now, for if I go not away, and he's talking in both terms, himself as the man Jesus whom the disciples knew, and also himself as the Christ. This awareness of transcendence, this spirit of the transcendent, we can all experience sometime, somewhere, and somewhere. When suddenly you step out of your front door on a night where the whole sky is just glittering with stars brilliantly, and for a fraction of a second, for a split second, you get the feeling, ah, my God. Just that little flash. You are in tune with the transcendent there. Or when you just sit quietly and watch the sun setting beautifully, the lovely changing of the colors and the extraordinary peace and quietness which envelops you, takes you into its very being, there too you experience transcendence. When the reality of transcendent love sometimes suddenly enters your heart in relation to a human being, to an animal, to a tree, a flower, anything whatsoever, to a perfect gem or a piece of music or whatever it is, then too you have lived the transcendent. So you have some sense of this. And then there come periods of time, the dark night of the soul, all that goes, and you can't bring it back. You are right caught right up in the smoke, dark smoke, acrid, pungent, terrible, shattering one's faith and belief, and it may last for years. Then one rushes to another for comfort. One stretches out one's hand and takes a pill, or opens a bottle and drinks the dangerous fluid and gets caught in it, and so forth. But that is the Christ which I realized going away from me. But that is the moment of opportunity as well as testing and trial. That is the opportunity. Now, because I, Vishnu, or the Transcendent, or the Christ, have gone away, you see, then the testing for this mind comes. Now is the opportunity. If the purification is effected, and can be effected, then there is a realization of the Transcendent which never goes. It is there always. If there is a momentary clouding, you can bring it back just like that. This is a fact. The Spirit of Truth, the Comforter. Now look at this word comfort. Confortis, with strength. Comfort doesn't mean, has no relationship to this sort of emotional, sympathetic, yes, my dear, I'm so sorry for you, poor little darling, and yes, poor little wretch, rather than poor little darling, in fact. But it is that. We have got this sort of meaning of comfort now, which has these emotional overtones, which simply means that we are in need of, we are looking for a sensation. Somebody comes and gives you comfort, puts his or her arms around you and kisses you and strokes you, you see, like you'd stroke your little cat and so forth. And that is comforting. It is undoubtedly comforting. But what, in what meaning of the word comforting? It is not strength-giving. It is sensation-gratifying. It's dope. It's an intellectual sensation. If it is not the purely physical and emotional sensation. This is hard. But you know, when the illness is serious, the antibiotic also has to be very powerful. It does that to your constitution, doesn't it? And you feel very, very bad for the time being. But don't think, therefore, that this is a cruel, heartless doctrine. Not at all. The sensation gratification is not the truly loving. This which appears at first to be rather cruel and rather terrible as the medicine. You know, they say, in a, as a joke, the cure is worse than the disease. You see? But it is this which is the truly loving thing, because it is the whole-making thing. Remember, unlike the body, the mind doesn't die. Reality doesn't die. It can be hurt, it can be strained, you can be in stress, but it will always be there. As the theistic religions put it, the soul is always there. They postulate eternity for the soul. The soul is immortal. This is just a postulate. But think of the significance and the implications involved in it. Because it is immortal, therefore if you've been a bad lad, you can be burnt and tortured by the devils for 20,000 million years, you see, till you've expiated all your sins. Your soul doesn't burn off, doesn't get executed with all the horrible torture that the devils inflict on you. They couldn't possibly have taught such a horrible teaching of hell unless they postulated that the soul was immortal. Otherwise, your rascal in this life will say, oh, that's all right, the moment the devil burns me, I'll be off again. That's the finish of it. That doesn't matter, I'll have a good time now. But seriously, there is this reality which is here and now is the imperishable. As Yajnavalkya said so positively in answering Gargi in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, that is the imperishable. All right. Now, realizing this imperishable, realizing the transcendence, one is completely at home with the source of all strength. There is comfort, beginningless, endless, perpetual comfort. After all, in the deepest crises of our lives, it is perfectly true others can help through intelligence, because of their intelligence, because there is something at least of real love between that person and myself. So there can be help, undoubtedly there can be help. But the real thing, the actual final doing, has to be by myself, isn't it? Again, if we take the analogy of an illness, it is I who have to take the medicine, and it is my body which has to be worked upon by the medicine in order to get healed. You can't swallow the pill on my behalf. You can't do it. At least you can swallow the pill, but I don't get well. It's like that. So the comforter. If I go not away, if this relationship of dependence does not get, not broken, now this is where we must be wise, not broken, but if this relationship of dependence does not get transformed, does not grow into the relationship of complete non-dependence, then there is no real comfort. The real strength. It becomes a relationship of non-dependence. And in becoming non-dependent, it becomes a complete and true relationship. Because no relationship between man and man, or between man and God, or whatever you like, you see, is a true relationship unless it is a free relationship. If there is constraint because of the relationship, then that is not a true relationship. If I claim, as a devout and a religious person who carries out all the instructions as laid down in the books, you see, if I claim that I am in relationship with God, God looks after me, etc., and then I say to myself or I say to my friend, oh, but I can't do that, that would offend God, I can't do it, I mustn't do it, oh no, no, no. And the struggle comes. What has happened actually? God has become something different. He's become an enemy. He's become a censor. He's become a judge, a punisher, a jailer. But that is no true relationship. The only true relationship is the relationship of loving union. That is all. There is no other relationship. That is the only real meaning of the word relationship. That it is a state of loving union. And that is all. And it is an all that includes the totality of the universe. And that is permanent strength, permanent comfort. That is fearlessness. There is reality there. That is truth. So, Jesus says, if I go not away and thereby make you go through this experience of fear, sorrow, and all the rest of it, there'd be no chance for you to realize the truth. The Comforter will not come unto you. The Strength Giver. Because the Strength Giver is just there. If the man-God relationship is a relationship of dependence, of tainted by the human type of dependence, then there is no comfort in reality. But when one becomes independent, one has become the alone, not the lonely, not the isolated, but in such complete and absolute relationship that one is alone. But it is an aloneness which includes the totality of the universe. Look, you and I are normally aware as just I myself, I Firoz, or I Greta, or I Norman, or whatever it is, isn't it? But supposing through this living organism, the psychophysical organism which goes by our own names, you see, if through this living organism the consciousness, the awareness is the real awareness of totality, then you and I, every single thing throughout the universe and I are a non-duality. And being a non-duality, there is no conflict, there is no fear, there is no hate. There is only the state of love which is utterly at peace, which is complete beauty, which is complete security. The uttermost security from the bonds, nirvana, as the Buddha declared. Is it not? And that is a relationship of independence, not from God, but with God and in God. You think of this in terms of the ordinary man-wife relationship. You know, you sometimes come across these emancipated people. You see, John and Mary are so emancipated that they can just do what they like, you see, and the other fellow doesn't care, or the other fellow, as the case may be. They don't care. Oh, no, he's quite free to do what he likes, she's quite free to do what she likes. Supposing there came near them somebody who had eyes to see, what would he see? Independence? Not the slightest. He would see nothing but miserable bondage. But if and when there is this real relationship, this real understanding and love, then all that is imposed upon each by the normal constraints of the actual situation and condition are fulfilled unconstrainedly. One doesn't neglect that. Otherwise, duties and responsibilities have no place, no meaning in actual life. Isn't that so? But they have complete place in actual life. How else does love manifest? How else could a relationship between man and wife, or brother and sister, or brother and brother, or father and son, or whatever it is, how else could that relationship be fulfilled excepting through all the normal duties and responsibilities inherent in the situation finding right expression? This is terribly important. This is practical. This has to be there. And the duties and responsibilities are not and will not be imposed by the one upon the other. But each, out of love, will inevitably see what the other needs and will just naturally do it. That is all. Now, time flies. Let us consider one very important matter. We have meetings like this, we talk like this, we consider together, we practice attentiveness, watchfulness and all that, because we are what we are. And we are still inadequate. We are still incomplete, unwhole, unholy that is. Therefore there is a necessity. Therefore there is meaning to growth, development, progress, realizing freedom, realizing transcendence and all the rest of it. Supposing the transcendence were a realized fact, then there's nothing to say, nothing to think about, nothing to do, nothing to worry about at all, nothing to strive for and so forth and so forth. Isn't that so? One just is. Just like God is. Remember, God is the grand senior. You know the difference between a senior and a grand senior? This is how an Italian defined it. Grand senior, a senior, is a person who does a little bit of work to earn his living. And a grand senior is a fellow who does no work, but has a living. That's the grand senior. God is the grand senior. We'd all be grand seniors. But we don't know the work that God does. God is action, will. But that will is the transcendent expression of what in us is split up as dualistic, conflicting desire. Now, let's leave that aside for the moment. That's another topic. What is it in us, then, that is at the center of our incompleteness? You know how Judeo-Christian tradition put it, sin, disobedience to the will of God. And you know how Hindu-Buddhist teaching has put it, ignorance they call it. Ignorance of what? And here, one of the so-called minor Upanishads, a very little known Upanishad, really gives a marvelous answer. To identify, mistakenly identify the transcendent as the real with this which we see and experience through our senses and our minds, to identify the two as reality, as the real, is the mistake we make. This is our ignorance. To put it in the terms of the Sarvasara Upanishad, The terms are simply the identification of the Atma with the not Atma is ignorance. The not Atma is that which is described, which is postulated as evil, as the origin of sorrow, misery, sin, etc., etc., etc. See, the world of dukkha. Now, how is it that you and I, as intelligent people, do identify like this? How is it that the identification comes about? We don't willfully do it. As far as our own natural voluntary urge is concerned, we want to be free of it, don't we? We want to have the reality of the transcendent instead of this dark illusion. Well, but what is it that just doesn't act properly? There's something in the machine, some nut, some bolt, some cog, which doesn't work properly. That cog is the mind. But which aspect of the mind, especially which aspect? As India put it, the Mayavic aspect, the power of Maya. As we would put it, the image-making faculty of the mind. The mind makes images. Of these images, only a very, very tiny part correspond to objective fact. The remainder are sheer fantasy, sheer meaningless, illusory fantasy. This is what we mistake for creative imagination. You know where real creative imagination is represented? Whenever in the great religions they say God created, then that is real creative imagination. It actually brings things into being. Can I, in my imagination, want a chair and produce a chair there? And then such a chair that I'll be able to look at it and say, it is good? I can't. I haven't got creative imagination. But I have the power of fantasy. Now this power of imagination, which is in the mind, weaves illusions about the nature of reality all the time and misleads us. This mind is the illusion maker. It projects a play upon the screen, so to say, like a cinema film, you see. It projects a play on the screen, and I fall into the trap of believing, oh, look at that, that's happening. Then I have to wake up and say, oh, of course, that was all untrue. But in actual life, it is all true for me. And this is where all the trouble comes. This image-making, this illusion-raising faculty. And it is fed by the misapplied, misdirected, ill-expressed psychical energy of desire in all the forms of greed, of resentment, of egoistic self-assertion and all the rest of it. That is how it is fed. See, all this doesn't apply in terms of worldliness. That is to say, if one wants to live the worldly life, eat, drink and be merry, wine, women and song, for tomorrow you'll probably repeat it before you die, you see, and so forth. Well, all right, carry on with that and just put a blue pencil through all this. But if you are really concerned, because it is natural for you to be concerned with the reality of religion, then one has to go into this. Otherwise not. Otherwise, yes, be
man of the world, you know, become prime minister, become a great business tycoon, own estates and run horses and win derbies and goodness knows what. The good old wheel will turn round, more dust will come up, you see, and then it will make a little show and then it will all become dust again and the wheel turns round and so the giddy game goes on. This mind then, this middle thing, the mind, we are aware, in very considerably aware of what we commonly call the body. That we are aware of. We are very much aware of things. The house in which we live, the car which we have, the office where we go to, or the school, or whatever it is, you see, etc., etc. We are aware of the town in which we live, the people, we are aware of the government. It's a wonderful instrument for every one of us to let off steam upon, you see. It is always wrong, but it never gets right, whatever it does, and so forth. We are very well aware of all that. All right. But are we aware of the real fact of it? The truth of it? That is a different matter. I am aware of it in a form, an illusory form made by my mind, at the back of which was the force of my greed. I wanted such and such a thing to happen, but instead Mr. Jenkins went and did this instead, you see, or Mr. whoever it is, or nowadays Mrs. or Miss, they are playing more and more part in the whole story. And so forth. Isn't that so? So even this, which I'm most aware of, I'm aware of in a confused, lopsided manner. Then, when I come to this tool of observation, the mind, this little mechanism of observation, oh dear, everything goes haywire altogether if I once look into it. I shrink back and say, oh my goodness, what an awful place. Still, for goodness sake, don't look there. Let's look at something beautiful. And I'm aware of a transcendent at certain magical moments. And they are remembered gratefully with joy and marvel and beauty. But what does my mind come and do there again? This is an extremely important point. My mind immediately makes a rigid shape. Ah, I had such and such an experience. And I fixate the transcendent in my ugly forms, my thought forms. Now, you must all worship this. And if you don't, that is why I conduct a crusade. That is why I will burn you at the stake for the good of your soul. You see? It's my mind, this foolish mind, which has come in and spoilt the transcendent. And since the mind holds this mid-position, this position of extraordinary importance and influence and controlling power over my whole life, because of that, the greater part, the greatest part of dukkha, of sin, of sorrow, of evil, has all been presented by the great teachers as existing in the mind of man. This is a fact which we have overlooked very much. In Buddhism, the greatest stress has been there, and also in the deeps of Hindu teaching. The greatest stress has been there, that is true. But in the other theistic religions, the stress has not been sufficient. In Zarathustrianism, there has been, perhaps of the theistic religions, in Zarathustrianism it has been strongest. Because there the whole teaching, the practical teaching, is summed up in good thoughts, good words, good deeds, good thoughts. The good mind, the vahu mano. This is, of course, the divine mind. The vahu means good, mind, mano mind, you see. So you see the importance of the mind. There, that is what you have to pick upon and work upon. Not by rushing to the psychiatrist. Because mind cannot be dealt with like a piece of mind, like a liver or a kidney. No transplant operations possible with the mind. The mind is a totality. It is a universal something. Where the body is concerned, out of the universal storehouse of the chemical atoms on this planet, the process of nature gets them together and puts a skin around the whole thing, and there is a separate fellow. But the mind, it cannot be done. It is a universal something, like space, like the air, if you like. It is a universal something, everywhere and total. So, the great teachers, this is where religion differs completely from medicine or psychiatry or anything like that. You have to look for yourself. You have to see for yourself. To put it this way, you have to cure your own blindness, your own deafness, your own neuritis, which has made you lose your sense of touch. You have to cure it yourself. And if a person asks, how can you do it? If I go not away, the Comforter will not come to you. The relationship of separateness and the false dependence has to change into the spirit of non-dependence, in the transcendent sense, not in the worldly sense, which is only as the sense of conflict, the egoistic self-assertion against difficulty and danger. That is all worldly nonsense. See? So, this mind is the thing, which is the important thing. And we who are in this group, who are really seriously concerned with religion, therefore our whole concern, our whole love is towards and for the transcendent reality of things. We must beware of the activity of the mind in making particular shapes and rigidifying them and saying, ah, this is the truth, I've got the truth. It never is a case of I've got the truth. It is always a case of living now so that the truth is manifesting. And every manifestation of the truth in the mind or even in physical matter itself must die the next moment and vanish away in order that the living truth may continue to live and manifest its livingness through throwing out new and new manifestations endlessly. You see, when one really sees that, one begins to get a glimpse of the meanings of the omnipotence, the omniscience, the omnipresence of God and so forth. You become aware of the whole universal process, oh, in an utterly indescribable manner. It is beyond anything and everything. And we never can know it, and we mustn't seek to know it with this mind. It will just surge through your whole being. And that is why the being, this limited being, has to have as its basis the moralities, the silas. Look into this very carefully. Not only the mind, but whether the basis of morality is there. And the essential point about the basis of morality is simply this. Am I pleasure-driven, or do I just see what is as what is and live accordingly from moment to moment? Because it's the pleasure drive and the ignorance that lies behind it, and the separate egoism that is associated with it. All these produce the complex of greed and resentment and ill will and malice and stupidity and all the rest of it. So, perhaps we have seen a lot through the Comforter. And in this, there is complete comfort. The strength of the infinite is here now. Beware of the words. Beware of the thoughts. But be aware of the reality.